With that, I will now turn it over to our moderator, Dr. Nurse Natalia Venus. Natalia is a senior science advisor at the US EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. Natalia, whenever you're ready.
Thank you so much, Molly. Thanks, and welcome everybody. It is really my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Mareti Garcia, an assistant professor of research medicine at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California. Her research focuses on uncovering how the immune system contributes to the progression of chronic liver diseases, and she will be introducing a new in vitro model for using 3D human liver spheroids to investigate how environmental pollutants like PFAS influence the progression of liver disease. Anna, now I will turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Natalia. Let me share with you my screen. Hello, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank the webinar organizers for an invitation and the opportunity to share with you the results and the progress that you have done with our project. Our project is being developed in the Superfund PFAS Assessment, Remediation, and Prevention Center at the University of Southern California, and is focused on deciphering the molecular and cellular mechanisms underlying PFAS-associated mesothelioma. The metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, or mesothelioma, is currently the leader cause of chronic liver diseases and affects up to 35% of adults in the U.S. Reports also show that affects up to 14% of children and adolescent. And this is a disease spectrum. It starts with abnormal accumulation of fat in the liver, characterizing the steatotic liver disease. And these can be due to several causes, such as high calorie intake, sedentary lifestyle, obesity and insulin resistance, and genetic predisposition. Up to 40% of the cases may develop some steroid inflammation characterizing the steatohepatitis, that also MASH, and some of these cases may also develop fibrosis. And up to this early stage of fibrosis, some of those cases can be treated and reversed. However, up to 20% of this case, they progress to advanced cirrhosis, advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis. And that makes the mesothelioma one of the main causes of cirrhosis nowadays. And unfortunately, part of these cases, they progress also to hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC. We also know that the other phases of the spectrum also can lead to HCC, and that can account for up to 13% of the annual incidence of HCC related to mesothelioma. Unfortunately, also, we have a prediction that by 2040, we may increase the prevalence of mesothelioma to 55%. And also, we may see an increase of MASH-related cirrhosis by the end of the 2040s, an increase of 91%. That makes us think that other factors besides those that are normally described and involved with mesothelioma progression, that we need to understand better those other identify other factors that can be contributing for disease progression. And among these factors, you know that environmental chemicals can participate, and among them we have PFAS. So PFAS is a forever chemical, and it's a group of more than 110,000 man-made chemicals that are widely used in industrial application. And one main characteristic of these chemicals is that they are highly resistant to degradation. And they are also detected in virtually every person in the United States. And this is due to the widely exposure that we have to these chemicals through contaminated water, non-stick cookware, food packaging, personal care products, and textiles. Among all the organs that we know that are affected by PFAS exposure, we have the liver, and we have studies that have described and associated PFAS exposure to liver hepatotoxicity, metabolic dysfunction, dyslipidemia, steatosis, and inflammation, and cancer. And most of this symptoms, they are related to MASLD. And there are some limitations in our knowledge now that make us to try to understand better if PFAS exposure can really be contributing to this disease, but limitations mainly regarding the mechanisms that are underlying this condition, the pathways and the metabolism cascades that are involved in this process, cell-specific impact, the changes in cell-cell communication are not described yet. And these limitations may be related to the limitations in available experimental models. So we have animal models for MASLD study that they do not fully recapitulate the disease. The human studies generally require years of follow-up. And the in vitro studies, they in general use one cell type and it's self-assembled in a monolayer and does not reproduce the architecture of the liver. And one very important limitation that we also have nowadays is the data integration. Very few studies integrate the in vitro or in vivo data sets with human findings. And this is what brought us together in the SHARP Center. So the main goals of the center is understanding the causal effect of PFAS in human liver disease, discovering mechanisms of PFAS hepatotoxicity, and this is conducted by the Bio Medical research projects. We also are interested in developing methods for comprehensive PFAS environmental assessment and also identify sustainable PFAS interventions. And this is going to be conducted by environmental engineer research projects. So the results that I'm going to show you today, they are related to the biomedical projects. So trying to understand how PFAS can impact the liver metabolism, we decided to adopt an in vitro model that we acquired from a company that's name is Ms. Farrell. And they had developed this multi-donor 3D human liver spheroids model. They acquire cells isolated from human postmortem liver, and they assemble in their lab different models of spheroids. The model that we are using currently is built with hepatocytes from five female and five male donors and non-parenchymal cells. And among the cells have cells that are involved in liver inflammation, so they are important for MASLD development. And once the cells are aggregated in an spheroid, they ship them ready to use to our lab. And they are shipped in the 96-well plate format. And these cells, these spheroids, they are cultured individually. And the type of plate that they use as accurate plate allow us a full exchange of the media, and that allow us to really do a better exposure to chemicals because of the type of density of the media that we can use. In addition to everything, for us, super important to use some product that's commercialized mostly because of quality control. So they guarantee to us that these spheroids, they are built and they have the right physiological behavior that can mimic a real liver. To decide our first experimental designs, we had based our decisions on two manuscripts that were published by a Health Canada group. And they had already used a similar in vitro model, also from that they acquired from Ms. Farrell. And they have evaluated the toxicity of about 25 PFAS. And they had done that measuring the supernatant for the cell death markers and also used a targeted bulk RNA sequencing using the TempleSeq technology. And they targeted toxicological genes, around 3,000 genes. And with that, they had defined that 20 micromolar is the best dosage that you don't have a cytotoxic activity, so you don't kill those spheroids, and also you have a good change in the differentially expressed genes because of exposure. So based on that, we had developed our framework. And for our framework, in addition to use this multi-donor liver microtissues, we combine that with multi-omic technologies. So we have optimized the dissociation of the cells of the spheroids to be used for single-cell RNA sequencing. And the idea of using the spheroids is to expose them to single or mixture PFAS. We select the PFAS that are mostly found in the human blood. And we also want to test if those effects of PFAS can be reversible. Besides the single-cell RNA sequencing, we also measure lipid accumulation in the spheroids using confocal microscopy, and we measure proteins and metabolites in the supernatant of these spheroids and try to integrate all this data set to have a better understanding of the impact of the PFAS in the spheroids physiology. And this is the group that is developing the project. So I'm going to present to data that we had recently published. One of these papers, we were focused on the single PFAS exposure, especially for PFHxS, PFOA, PFOS, and PFNA. So here you can see that this is a confocal image that you can see in red the lipid that's accumulated. So one of the features of PFAS exposure is increase of lipid accumulation. And we can see that steroids exposed to PFHxS and PFOA had this increase in a significant way. We know also the hepatocytes are the main cells in the liver that will accumulate fat. So we decided to focus our attention in the transcriptome coming from those PFAS. From the hepatocytes. And the hepatocytes, as I mentioned before, in this model, they are from male and female donors. So we, using bioinformatic tools, we can separate them. We can recognize cells carrying XX and XY chromosomes, and that give us the possibility of investigating not only the PFAS effect in the bulk hepatocytes, but also according to the biological sex. In the case of PFHxS, we see that the induction of this increase in lipid accumulation probably is a result of inhibition of lipid transportation. So there's an inhibition of events of the cells going to secrete cholesterol or lipids. So that probably can help with. Can result in lipid accumulation for steroids exposed to PFHxS. In the case of PFOA, we can see an increase in pathways that are related to lipid biosynthesis. And this is important also to distinguish compared to PFHxS. And we also see that PFOA has a strong effect in hepatocyte from female donors. And this highlights for us the importance of considering the biological sex when we are studying PFAS effect in human health. Another effect that we observed in these spheroids was the upregulation of pro-oncogenic pathways. So there is a bioinformatic tool, the assay AtoMic, that allow us to detect the cells if the cells are carrying a transcriptomic cancer signature. And we saw that cells that were exposed to PFNA have an increase of this signature. And when we observe the number of cells that are carrying the signature, they go up to 61%. And when we observe the location of the cells, they are located in the cluster of hepatocytes. So we also focus again in the transcriptome of the hepatocytes to try to understand the mechanisms of the pro-oncogenic mechanisms of PFAS. When you compare among all of them, we really see that PFNA not only upregulated pathways that are related to cell transformation, or colony formation, things that are related to, direct with cancer, but also they increased the expression of genes related to cell cycling, oxidative stress, DNA damage repair, and inflammation. And all these processes are important for cancer development. We see that PFOS, although we don't see a significant increase in the number of cells carrying a cancer signature, we see that PFOS has a stronger effect in cancer pathways, especially in hepatocytes derived from men. And the last activity that we saw that was important to mention in the asteroids was regarding to the immune response. We saw a strong immune suppressive effect of the PFAS that we studied, especially for the T and NK cells. The cells exposed to PFOS or PFNA, they show a strong inhibition of cell cytotoxicity. And this brings us the awareness that inhibiting the immune response at this level may also contribute for cancer development. We also saw that the Kupffer cells, that they are liver-resident macrophages, they also suffer some inhibition, especially when exposed to PFHXS, PFOA, and PFOS. And together with the transcriptomic data, we confirmed this inhibition of production of cytokines that are important for inflammation using Luminex. So we targeted proteins that we know that are important for hepatic inflammation, and we saw that all of them had inhibited the secretion of these proteins as well. And another event that we also try to observe in this specific scenario that's using the asteroids and using single-cell RNA sequencing is cell-to-cell communication. When we look here at the control, we see that we have a number of significant cell-cell communication events that normally you're going to find in those spheroids. And we observe that all the PFAS have inhibited the number of cell-cell communication events, especially PFOS. This communication is between hepatocytes, Kupffer cells, and TNK cells, and also cross conversations. And we observed that, especially for PFOS, the inhibition of pathways, the majority were related to the immune response. Again, showing how the impact of exposure to PFAS affect not only the upregulation of genes that are important for lipid metabolism, or genes that are important for cancer, but also how that inhibits the cell-cell communication and disturb the liver as an organ. In parallel, we were conducting a translational study with the project too. And in this project, we are trying to understand the mechanisms underlying PFHPA associated mesold. So the project too that's led by Dr. Lida Chatzy, and was developed by Brittany Baumert. They have access to several cohorts. So the cohort that they were using for this study was composed of adolescents with severe obesity. And these adolescents, they had mesold confirmed by biopsy, and they also had access to the plasma of these teenagers. And in this plasma, they had measured the PFAS concentrations, the metabolites, and also proteins. And they detected that PFHPA was the PFAS that better related with disease progression. So having that in mind, we went to the lab and then we tested how PFHPA exposure could be involved with mesold. So we had followed the same framework that I had explained before. And after we had our data sets, we integrated the omics from the human and the in vitro study and tried also to extrapolate this data to identify biomarkers that could indicate individuals that could identify individuals at high risk of developing MASLD because of PFHPA exposure. So for the human study results, they showed that PFHPA was not only associated with the disease, but also with disease severity, and that increasing concentrations of PFHPA would also be related with disease, will increase the chance for those adolescents to have the disease. In our in vitro studies, we observing the categories of biological processes, they were upregulated in the spheroids. We saw that lipid metabolism was the main category. And we confirmed that by confocal imaging, and we saw that there is a significant increase in accumulation of fat in the spheroids exposed to PFHPA. And when you look at the hepatocytes, we also saw that the lipid metabolism was still the main category that was upregulated. And observing the pathways involved in this metabolism, we saw that a regulation of lipid metabolism by PPAR-alpha was the top pathway upregulated, followed by fatty acid oxidation, and also by other pathways linked to lipid biosynthesis. That suggests to us that one of the main effects of PFH exposure is induction of lipid accumulation in the liver cells. So we integrate these data sets. We had used the OmicsNet to do this process. So in this process, we would overlap pathways that were commonly found in gene expression data set and the metabolomics data set, or gene expression data set and the proteomic data set. All of them had indicated that lipid metabolism is one of the main pathways that were common in our in vitro data set and the human findings. And this allowed us to identify 19 metabolites and 6 proteins as potential biomarkers for PFHPA exposure. And we took those biomarkers for an integration using the latent unknown clustering or LUCID program that was developed by Dr. Dave County. That's our DMAC leader. And with that, you have different layers of data integration. So then you can try to extrapolate that information to the real life. So in this level, first, we have the combination between PFHPA exposure and the presence or absence of those metabolites or of those proteins. And we saw that this relationship increased significantly when we included the disease outcome. So yes or no, MASLD, we observed that the relationship between PFHPA exposure, presence of those proteins, and the disease increased in a very significant way. And these allow us to say that these 6 proteins are possibly biomarkers that could identify a subgroup of adolescents with severe obesity to have an increased risk of developing MASLD. So we have work in progress, and we also have next steps that I'd like to share with you. So the work that we have in progress now is to study the PFAS mixtures. So we have some data sets that we had evaluated PFAS mixtures in equal concentrations and a final concentration that is the one that we're using before, 20 micromolar, in different times of exposure and also exposing them for a week and allowing them to recover for another week and observe if we can reverse those events that were upregulated by PFAS exposure. But we also now are more interested in going close to what is physiologically relevant and try to see if we still can detect these biological changes that can be important to really understand these mechanisms and what is happening in the body, right? So then we are using plasma ratios of these 5 PFAS mixtures in a concentration that also are physiologically relevant. And for next steps, we want to go and analyze those individual PFAS also in the same low physiological relevant concentrations for different times of exposure, and also include other emerging PFAS that we had detected in the environment or in the blood of our cohorts, and try to study their impact on liver physiology. So with that, I'd like to thank all the collaborators. This is an extensive work. We have been working together for these last 3 years, especially Dr. Lucy Golden, that's our project leader, and Matthew Solomon, that's our amazing bioinformatician, and all the other persons that are involved in this project, the funding sources, and the centers that support our progress. And I'm happy to respond to any questions now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna. That was awesome. We do have some questions for you. The first one is, what is the exposure concentrations of PFAS PFNA in the cancer risk determination study?
So for now, we so as I said before, we had the term only use that first concentration that we know that's not cytotoxic, but in when we go for in vitro models in general, we have much higher concentrations than we are going to use in you know that you can see in vivo. So now we are in the progress of testing lower concentrations. We can see that we still have some signal of cancer, even using lower concentrations. But I think the most important for us now is to understand if the signals are permanent or not after the removal of PFNA.
And I guess as a follow-up, maybe similar answer. Again, what is the exposure concentrations of PFAS, PFNA, PFOS in the immune study?
So it's the same concentration, 20 micromolar. So that's what we studied. That was our first study. But one thing that I can already say that using these other lower concentrations that are more physiological, we also changed the category, the biological categories that are upregulated, they are more affected by PFAS. So with that, we know the importance of really going for lower and different concentrations to try to understand better the impact of them on the liver physiology.
Thank you. And as Molly mentioned before, feel free, everybody, to put your questions in the Q&A pod. All right, one more. Did you compare the gene expression data from liver spheroids with that published by others? It is curious that you did not see an increase in steatosis with PFOS, well-known in vivo phenotype.
So yeah, at least in the concentration that we have tested, we do not see an increase. But one thing that we always need to always remember is that in the body, we have a mixture of PFAS. It's not only one PFAS. We have a higher among the ratios of PFAS, PFOS has a higher ratio, but still we are trying to understand the synergy. And isolated, that's the effect that we saw. But when you combine with other PFAS, we don't know if they potentialize the lipid metabolism or the increase in lipid accumulation.
Thank you. Another question. What are the average concentrations of PFAS that we do detect in public serum or blood?
So when we sum the concentrations of those five PFAS that we are interested, we have in the average American 20 nanomolar. That's the average. When you go for areas where you have higher contamination or because of the environment that they are contaminated or because of occupational activities, we can see 80 or higher nanomolars. And that's why we want to study the impact of these different concentrations.
Thank you. One more. In your first study, could you please comment on the relevance of the use test doses to environmental dietary exposure levels in humans?
Let me see here. So, as I said, like in the first study, we did not focus in what is exposure. We just focused in what was shown in vitro as toxicologically relevant. So, the studies that were performed before, and now we are developing our own, so we can really be fully aware of the variations that are involved, they had shown that you really could detect some biological changes when you expose them to a higher concentration, higher than you normally are exposed to, or by diet or by environment. And that's where we started. And now that we are also testing this lower concentrations, but using the technology, like the combination of technologies that we are that we had established in the group, we see that we can detect other activities that were not shown before. And that's why now we have the confidence that we can go with lower concentrations and still try to extract information.
Thank you. Another one, with the emergence and integration of AI in science, how do you see AI being helpful or not helpful to remediation detection of PFAS?
I think that the AI can help us to first establish better ways that people have access to information. So if you can have softwares that are developed, and then we can upload information to those softwares, people can be more aware. We understand that when you go for policy and regulations, things they are slower. But once we can identify those effects in vitro, transfer that to the in vivo models, like the human studies, and have something that's really validated, we can upload this information and people can be more aware of what is happening.
Thank you. One more for reference. Have you compared the potency of your PFAS compounds with known peroxisomal proliferation drugs in the in spiro human cell system?
We have not. We have not.
Okay. I have a few more questions for you. Have you observed differences in the impact of short versus long chain PFAS on liver spheroids?
We did. When like the four PFASs that I had shown in the first study, the legacy ones are the longer ones, and they affect most the hepatocytes. That's where we saw the biggest change in gene expression. And the PFHxS, the shorter one that we had studied with that group, and we saw that non-parenchymal cells, that are cells that are more inside of the spheroids, they were also more affected. With PFHPA, that's the second study, we also saw that although hepatocytes were affected, T cells were very much affected by it as well. So we understand that probably according to the size of the PFAS, they have a different capacity of penetration in the spheroids, and that, gave us the idea of this interaction with possibly proteins, or possibly even receptors in the cells, and make themselves react in a different way. They are more susceptible, to the PFAS.
Great, thanks. One more. Did PFAS show overlapping gene expression signatures?
We were surprised that it did not.
Okay.
When we comp like we saw common pathways, overall pathways, but when we compare the genes that were up or down regulated by PFAS exposure, actually there was not that big overlap. So each one has really a specific way, specific targets in the cell.
I have just one more, unless oh, I got another one. Have you compared your gene expression profiles with rodent profiles?
We had not compared directly, but there's l several papers that were published with rodent model, and they had shown that PPAR alpha is the one of the main targets for PFAS function activity. And we saw that's true of our model as well. We saw that all the PFAS in some way, they have affected PPAR alpha regulation, and especially the regulation of lipid metabolism.
Thank you. One more is the last I have for now. Do these PFAS appear to target shared gene networks despite structural differences?
So as I said before, they do not fully overlap. We saw that some of them had affect PPAR alpha, but we see is a very specific behavior, really, and that makes is even more aware the importance of studying the PFAS individually to understand, to instruct also the policymakers of how controlling them.
I don't see any more questions, so I think we'll just move on to the next. Thank you so much, Anna. That
You're
was
welcome.
great. We appreciate you. And next, there you are. We have Guru Ulaganathan, a third-year PhD student in the Integrated Toxicology and Environmental Health Program at Duke University. His research focuses on studying the effects of heavy metals on developmental neurotoxicity. And today he will introduce new 3D brain cell models called brain spheres to study toxic exposures. Guru, please feel free to begin whenever you're ready. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Natalia. Let me make sure that my screen is being shared because I think you can see my dog.
You see your puppy.
Oh,
Yep.
perfect. Thank you so
There
much.
you are.
So, hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining this webinar. Today, I'll be broadly talking about leveraging some of these brain organoids to study neurodevelopmental toxicity, or DNT. I will not talk about any results that we are working on currently here at the Duke Superfund Center because we're currently actively modeling the exposures to these heavy metals in PAHs, and we will have the results in the coming months. So, that's kind of exciting. So, today will be just a general talk about how we can use or leverage these brain organoids to assess neurodevelopmental toxicity. So essentially, to begin, what is developmental neurotoxicity, or DNT? And simply put, it is the harmful effects of compounds on the developing nervous system. So these are the compounds that have the ability to change the normal neurodevelopmental trajectory. So one key point here that I want to emphasize is that these early exposures that take place don't often need to be at these high doses. So the immediate manifestation of symptoms is really not that necessary. Rather, they can be quite subtle, and they can end up causing what we call neurological deficits later in life. And these lower dose induced changes often make up what's known as silent neurotoxicity. So just as an example of a neurodevelopmental toxicant, nicotine is able to inhibit processes such as brain growth and myelination, and affect the functioning of key regulatory genes that modulate brain structure and function. And just to illustrate another key feature of DNT by contrasting with NT, or normal neurotoxicity, is that one distinguishing aspect is that exposure-induced changes that occur during this developmental period can be permanent, while the same exposure that occurs as an adult can be transient. So one key reason here, or one key reason behind this, is that there's this constant flux that takes place during neurodevelopment. There's rapid growth taking place. You have markers that are changing all over the time. So it makes it more susceptible to external influences. So what ends up happening here is that you're actually affecting processes like neurogenesis and gliogenesis, rather than acting on individual neurons or synapses. So if I try to analogize it a little bit, it's like switching from A to B or B to C, because it really isn't a baseline set here yet. You're fundamentally altering something before it has a chance to even be normal. So that's what makes DNT much more complex than regular neurotoxicity. So furthermore, from this pyramid, you can see that these are the classified developmental neurotoxicants in 2006. There were five. So according to current regulatory guidelines, there are actually no requests immediately for DNT studies prior to the registration of new chemicals, because recommendations are often based on triggers such as structural similarities, reproductive toxicants, or endocrine disrupting chemicals. And even when you do make these requests, OECD guidelines require you to test these in rodent models, which can take a really long time, over 2 years, and can be really expensive. They cost approximately $1.4 million per chemical. So really, the feasibility of testing a wide number of chemicals and screening them for developmental neurotoxicity is quite improbable. So this is just an updated figure from 2025. The number of classified neurotoxicants, as you can see, has gone up by eight. So you have 14 classified developmental neurotoxicants. So it really highlights the disparity that's present in being able to classify and test a wide range of chemicals as developmental neurotoxicants. So, because here we at the Duke Superfund Center study, one of the heavy metals that we study is lead. I just want to briefly showcase or highlight one of its effects. This is a great video with beautiful illustrations from this called Little Things Matter: The Impact of Toxicants on the Developing Brain. And it talks about how there are all of these toxicants that are present in the environment, and all of these toxicants that are present in our body, but extremely minute changes in their concentrations can have an extremely huge impact. For example, here, an increase in lead concentration by 10 parts per billion can cause a 5-point drop in IQ scores. So while this drop in 5 points seems very subtle and not very discernible when you're looking at two individuals, this drop from 100 to 95 points, when you consider an entire population, is quite substantial. So essentially, what happens here is that this would result in a 57% increase in the number of individuals whose IQ is now below 70, and a consequent decrease in the number of kids who's having an IQ greater than 130. I just wanted to highlight this because this is an important factor to consider, because here we're just taking into account one toxicant. So we like to say that we live in this chemical soup, and we're not isolated in our exposures because we have all of these multiple exposures all occurring at once. So one of the problems with studying, or one of the things about studying the developing brain or neurodevelopment is that you need to be able to study a broad range of processes and cell types that fall under this umbrella. It is a non-exhaustive list, but this figure sums up some of the important or fundamental processes. I will reference this figure again in a few slides. So we essentially need a way of being able to capture and study at least some or all of these processes in a way that's relevant to humans. So how do we actually go about doing that? So this is where the advent of iPSCs has really played a major role in toxicology. Everybody knows it. So you collect these fibroblasts, usually from healthy or diseased humans, depending on the goal of your research. These fibroblasts are then reprogrammed to iPSCs using these Yamanaka factors, which are pluripotency factors. And finally, when you do have these iPSCs, you can further differentiate them into mature cells of your choice using several different growth factors. So you have this direct human to dish conversion that tackles some of the interspecies differences that are associated with using animal models. And another key advantage of using iPSCs is that they can be differentiated into both 2D and 3D models, each with their own advantages and disadvantages. For example, in 2D cultures, they're homogeneous, they're easily scalable. However, you do have a little bit of a lowered physiological relevance in the absence of cell-to-cell interactions. 3D models, on the other hand, have these multicellular interactions and self-organization, which, when considering the brain as an important process, they do come with some disadvantages, such as insufficient neutron diffusion, limited vascularization. All of these can often lead to co-necrosis in bigger organoids. So, given the complexity of the brain and the fact that we do work with organoids here at Duke, brain organoids, we do believe that brain organoids offer a powerful tool to study the extreme variety that's present in the brain. So, brain organoids have actually been here for more than a decade now, with multiple different models, multiple different brain regions being studied. Some of these models even include a combination of multiple different brain region organoids to encompass structures called MRBOs. So, given the focus on toxicology and what we do, we work with this brain microphysiological system right over here that was developed by researchers at Johns Hopkins University, and these are called brain spheres. So, one advantage or one key advantage of using these brain spheres are that they show a controlled increase in size. So, in the absence of growth spurts, which are often responsible for co-necrosis, furthermore, there are multiple organoids in a dish, and they show incredible reproducibility between batches and between different experiments, and in terms of consistency between multiple experimental runs. Additionally, these brain spheres show the emergence of multiple key neural cell types, including neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes, all temporally. So this stepped appearance helps in modeling how the system would react in the presence or absence of a certain cell type to a toxicant. Another key functional aspect of any brain organoid model is the presence or absence of neuronal activity, which can be measured through methods like microelectrode arrays or patch clamp electrophysiology. So these brain spheres, when they're plated on electrodes here on the left in panels D and E, are electrically active spontaneously and show continuous increases in electrical activity when you plate them after 3 weeks. So this electrical activity is often driven by the oscillation of glutamatergic and GABAergic signals, which you can visualize with the help of MEAs, where they can be continuously monitored. So these can help in identifying the moment of divergence when these organoids that are chronically acutely exposed to environmental chemicals shift their communication patterns. So coming back to this figure, if we do go through these processes, we are able to capture a lot of them or a majority of them. Yes, there is a lack of extrinsic signals, such as the role of sex hormones. And here I'll just highlight that here the most glaring omission in this figure here is the lack of an immune environment, which is provided by the microglia. But that too has been addressed recently. So microglia are important for processes like brain homeostasis, important for mediating neuroinflammation. And because they originate from yolk sac progenitors, unlike neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes, and then they migrate into the brain before the closure of the blood-brain barrier, they're normally absent in these brain organoid models as an inherent component of these models. So this issue has been resolved with the reproducible incorporation of microglia progenitors that can survive long-term, which is important over the course of 9 weeks so far in the brain spheres model. And another key advantage of this microglia incorporated BMPS is that they exhibit enhanced neuronal activity and maturity and provide the scalable, reproducible model that can be used for neurodevelopment and disease modeling. So essentially, if I go back to this figure now, we can encompass the full triad of processes or key cell types that fall under this umbrella of fundamental neurodevelopmental processes. So now there's the question of, has the system actually been used to study a range of different toxicants and their subsequent responses? And the answer to that question is yes, they have, and they are continuing to be used to do so. So I'll just provide a couple of examples of how these brain spheres are able to capture these cell type specific effects. So 6-OHDA, which is 6-hydroxy dopamine, is a compound that's known to induce Parkinsonism and has been extensively used to model PD. So here you can see that an exposure to a 6-OHDA causes a dose-dependent decrease in TH expression, which is a marker for dopaminergic neurons. And I'm not showing it here, but also causes a dose-dependent increase in reactive oxygen species. In agreement with this observation of decreased TH expression, qPCR results have also shown an increased expression of GSD01 and SAW2. So this compound, the brain spheres, is able to show selective TH loss without changing the staining of general neuronal markers visualized through NF or neurofilament. Another example of these brain spheres being able to capture cell type specific effects is cuprizone. So cuprizone is a copper chelating agent that leads to oligodendrocyte cell death and subsequent demyelination. So in these brain spheres, when you expose them to CPZ, there was a decrease in the number of mature oligodendrocytes visualized by MBP positive cells, and overall MBP expression has decreased, suggesting that cuprizone treatment does result in demyelination. Additionally, what about the other cell type, astrocytes? So exposure to amiodarone, which is an antiarrhythmic medication, affects astrocytic expression here, causing reductions in S100B and G5 expression through RT-PCR. But a week later, here in this figure, you can see that S100B immunolabeling shows increased expression of astrocytes. So essentially, you can use these brain spheres to capture specific cell type specific effects. So they are able to capture subtle variations, and they are able to show how specific compounds, you can identify specific mechanistic pathways or cell types through which these compounds are affecting different neural cell types in the brain. Another important thing about using these brain spheres is that because they show the stepped emergence of all those key cell types, you can use them to model temporal effects of neurodevelopment. So these are so the so basically using them to model effects in the presence or absence of different cell types, and how an early exposure, for example, an exposure that occurs early on, can affect the later emergence of cell types. So here, just to provide an example of some preliminary data of an exposure we did to CBD that is not a Superfund chemical, it causes essentially the alteration of expression of all of these key neural cell types. You have NPCs here, you have neurons, you have astrocytes, you have different neuronal subtypes. You have glutamatergic, GABAergic neurons, as well as KLB1 dopaminergic neurons. So essentially, early exposure affects these the expression of these different the gene expression of these neuronal markers. But when you expose them, for example, at a later time point, maybe at week three, when some of the markers are more mature and levels have become steady, you see totally different effects. So here, just to compare it, you see an upregulation in dopaminergic expression here, are not as many effects on synaptogenesis here. So essentially, you are able to see how the brain sphere or the neurodevelopmental trajectory is affected in the presence or absence of key cell types. So just, oh, I'm speeding through this. That's great. So just to conclude, what I've shown so far is that human brain development is such an incredibly complicated and complex process that inherently makes it hard for DNT to model. But brain organoids that are generated from these iPSCs are a powerful tool to be able to capture this in a human-relevant manner. And currently, at the Duke Superfund Center, we are modeling physiologically relevant exposures to heavy metals and pHs, including cadmium and lead. And we're very excited because we are seeing some interesting results, which we hope to publish in the coming months. But it brings me back to this question of what is the overall purpose and use of using these brain organoids to study Why do we need to use these brain organoids to even study something as complicated as brain development? Because the value of these human brain organoids is not that they are replacing everything else, but they are changing how we ask questions about DNT. So they fall into the category of us trying to advance these new approach methodologies, but they can also be employed for precision medicine approaches where you can take cells from patients with ASD or Alzheimer's and use that to model in vitro how they are individually being affected by exposures or other environmental factors. So additionally, they also are able to capture like these dose dependent molecular and functional changes before cytotoxicity, so they can help define biologically relevant safety thresholds that are more informative. And rather than eliminating actually animal studies entirely, these approaches do help us or do allow for a more targeted and hypothesis-driven in vivo testing approach. Therefore, you reduce the number of animals that are needed while also increasing the interpretability. So essentially, these are really changing the way we think about complicated processes and allow us to essentially be able to address these. It's not exhaustive again, all of these questions and many, many more, but it's just an incredibly powerful starting tool for us to begin to understand human brain development. And before I end, I would like to obviously acknowledge everybody who has supported me and helped me. So that would be the Duke Superfund Research Center and the National the Superfund Research Program that falls under the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. I'd like to thank my lab, the Murphy Lab, and my mentor and advisor, Dr. Susan Murphy. So that's pretty much my presentation.
Thank you so much, Guru. That was great. I have a few questions for you, and people remember we have questions to add them to the Q&A pod. So first question, what are you using this model for now?
Perfect. So we're using this model to study temporally, so a wide range of different chemicals. We're using to study lead, cadmium, and BAP as physiologically relevant exposures. That's one of the things that we often fail to take consider when we're like dosing them in vitro, because we can add them directly to the dish. So one of the things that we are trying to do is identify, model, and basically completely characterize even the subtle effects through epigenetic modifications of how early exposure to these chemicals can cause later life effects, because that's one of the things that we really are honing in on here at the Duke Superfund Research Center. And we are using it to study non-superfund chemicals like cannabinoids, which are to me of great personal interest as well.
Great. One more question. Thank you very much for your presentation. Did you publish results of your studies on heavy metals and pH or other chemicals?
They're coming out very soon. We are hoping to wrap up the experiments in next by May, the end of May, and hopefully we will have results out by early August, September. That's the hope. As always with working with the models, is some refinement that takes place in choosing the doses and testing a wide range of doses, because we want to capture the physiologically relevant doses, but we also want to make sure that this was a new model that we incorporated at the Duke Superfund Research Center from Hopkins. So it did take a little bit of testing and playing around with to make sure that we had a grip on it.
Great, thank you. Another one. To what extent has this research been shown to assist in addressing brain-related conditions in real time, and how accurate are its results?
So I'll always caveat the fact that these are much, much more simplified in vitro. They're not going to capture the full complexity of the in vivo developing brain. I will say that there's still an edge that animal models hold in that regard, in the fact that even when we model these organoids, we have like focused on cortical organoids. But with the advancements of MRBOs, there was a paper that was published from Hopkins where they came up with these multi-region brain organoids, where they had a cortical a brain organoid, they had a midbrain, and they had endothelial to kind of get the blood-brain barrier. They did single cell RNA sequencing, and they used data from, I believe, a repository to compare how much of it does the how much of the MRBO maps to the fetal human brain. And they were able to capture, I believe, 85% of all the cell types and regions in the MRBO. They were able to capture it. Again, I will caveat the fact that there are going to be some disadvantages, but one of the biggest things is getting over that interspecies difference. you are actually getting human relevant cells. And another huge advantage is because you're able to do the GXE, the gene X environment thing, where you can take the cells from the diseased patients. If you want to study Alzheimer's or any kind of brain disorder, you can take cells from them and model it. And I've actually spoken to the researchers at Hopkins where they do see differences, just inherent differences in the brain organoids that are derived from diseased patients versus the normal control brain organoids. I hope that answered that question.
Think so. Okay, the next question for you. To what extent has this research been shown to assist in addressing brain-related conditions in real time? Oh,
Oh, I
this is the
think.
same one. Never mind, it was repeated. So another one, very clear presentation. Thank you. How did the doses of 6-OHDA compare with therapeutic doses?
That's a great point. So in that paper, they did use I don't so I do not believe there's a therapeutic dose. 6-OHDA itself is an extremely toxic substance. It's usually used as kind of a positive control because it's a known model. It's like that along with MPTP is one of those chemicals. If you're exposed to it, you can develop PD. So you need to be extremely careful. And I don't know if there's really a safe therapeutic dose based out of my knowledge, but I do know that they usually use as positive controls to model PD. And in that paper, they were using it to show that it selectively affects these dopaminergic neurons without affecting general neuronal loss. So you do not have general neuronal loss. They visualize that through neurofilament staining, but they could selectively see targeting of the mitochondrial pathways as well as dopaminergic neurons. So essentially showing that these brain spheres are not, you're not having general neuronal loss. You can actually use them to look at specific individual subtypes of cells.
Great, thank you. Next question for you. What is the typical shelf life or half-life or brain organoids?
Great point. Great question. And it's changed since they first started coming out almost, I think, 13 years ago, which to me sounds insane how much we've progressed. But the model that we use, you can keep it in culture for up to 20 weeks without having any issues, but we usually don't try to keep it because kind of after 15, 12 to 15 weeks, you start losing. That's one of the problems with iPSCs, a little bit more volatile than the normal cancer cell lines, and they're quite expensive as well, and they require a lot of care. So there have been some models like the Lancaster model where you can keep it, I believe, also up to like 80 days. It's been they have come up with ways to vascularize these models. You can keep it in culture for like a much more extended period because that's one of the big disadvantages because cells start dying without proper vascularization. And the brain spheres are really advantages in the sense that they don't get so big enough that we have to worry about the nutrients not reaching the center. But from what we have seen, you can keep it in culture up to 20, 15 to 20 weeks. It depends on the question that you're trying to address at the end of the day. If you're waiting to see early exposures, you can obviously don't need to keep it that long. But if you're waiting to see like when all my cell types come in and I now want to see how it robustly, reacts to an exposure, might want to keep it for longer. And now with the microglial incorporation, which is super important, they have been able to keep it up for 9 weeks. And I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes much longer as they kind of refine the model a bit more.
Well, thank you very much. I don't see any more questions, so we appreciate your talk. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And we're going to move to our next speaker and last speaker of the day. Our final speaker today is Dr. Weixu Chu, professor in the Department of Veterinary Physiology and Pharmacology at Texas A&M University. And his research in human health risk assessment includes toxicokinetics, physiological-based pharmacokinetic modeling, dose response assessment, characterizing uncertainty and variability, a systematic review, meta-analysis with particular interest in Bayesian and probabilistic methods. Dr. Chu will discuss how NAMs can be used to improve health risk assessment. We'll now turn it over to you. The floor is yours.
All right, thank you very
And
much. I appreciate the opportunity to present to this group. I see there's 100 Almost 200 attendees, and it's really a privilege to share our work here from Texas A&M. Can you see that all right? Is that coming through? Okay, great. So I'm going to talk about a few case studies in this sort of theme of cells to solutions to basically moving towards a next generation risk assessment approach and using the context of environmental disasters as kind of a test bed for these types of approaches. I'm the deputy director of our Texas A&M Superdrone Center, is also the director of our Risk and Geospatial Sciences Corps. I spent 14 years at US EPA, so I've been on the other side as well in terms of conducting assessments on the inside and then helping states and localities and other program offices in doing the actual cleanup work. I wanted to start by really thanking our entire center. This is really a team effort. I'm going to go through some case studies and overview, so not as deep dive into any individual approach, and we can always dive deeper into in the Q&A session. But I wanted to give you sort of a survey of different risk assessment kind of relevant approaches that our center is being developed. Also, special thanks to Von Rusen, who's our overall director, as well as the individual project and core PIs. So going back to to risk assessment. So this paradigm is really almost over 20 years, over 40 years old, I'm sorry, and goes back to the 1983 National Research Council report, Risk Assessment in the Federal Government Managing the Process. And so it really boils down to four different components. There's hazard identification, identifying what agents cause what types of adverse effects, including the mechanisms of those effects. There's dose response assessment, trying to characterize the relationship between dose and the incidence of effects, in humans. There's exposure, which is who is being exposed, what levels, and by what routes are they being exposed. And also in terms of like cleanup or interventions, how that exposure would change with different types of risk management. And then finally, risk characterization, which is putting exposure, hazards, and dose response together to characterize what is the anticipated incidence of adverse effects in the population. But as emphasized in this report, risk assessment is not in isolation. There's a context both sort of before and after risk assessment. The Superfund research centers are really focused on the research to inform risk assessment, whether that's epidemiologic studies, clinical studies, experimental animal studies, in vitro studies, computational modeling. And then risk assessment then feeds into the risk management process, which takes into account also not just scientific considerations, but social, economic, and legal factors that can lead to a decision, say, to ban a substance, to develop exposure standards, to identify priorities for assessment or decision making, as well as to prioritize research. And so, in theory, the risk management context should feed backwards to the risk assessment in terms of what type of needs there are for assessment, and then the risk assessment itself then feeds back into determining research needs so that the data and models can be developed to move forward. Now, this is typically a very long road from research to action. So it's going to take trichloroethylene as an example. This is a chemical I worked on when I was at US EPA. This is a research study that we published in 2009 on population pharmacokinetics of looking at interspecies as well as inter-individual variability. The research on trichloroethylene goes back, to the 1950s, if not before. And so this is really a large range of studies that are being assessed into the risk assessment process. So at EPA, there is the IRIS. The IRIS program was in charge of developing these toxicological reviews, which did the hazard identification and the dose response part. So looking not just at human studies and experimental animal studies, but also looking at mechanistic studies, and then developing dose response analyses to come up with toxicity values. And these toxicity values are what is compared to the exposure levels to characterize risk. So EPA completed its risk evaluation of trichloroethylene now in 2020, where they looked at various use cases across the country, and it estimated the exposures from these use cases and then compared to the toxicity values that were developed in the hazard and dose response review. So then in 2023, a regulatory rule was proposed to ban TCE, with a timeline as to the types of as when those bans would take place. This again take into account not just the scientific but also economic, legal, and social factors in developing this proposed rule. The rule was finalized at the end of 2024. The date there is December 17, 2024. But that's not the end because there's still a implementation of the rule. So there were prohibitions within 1 year and then other prohibitions that were staggered over the next 50 years. And then there's a specific section during this 50-year phase out that requires strict worker protections so that inhalation exposures stay below 0.2 ppm during that phase out period. Now, this was in the subject of various types of legal challenges and litigation. The latest from November of last year was that this final Section 6G TSCA exemption would be postponed again till February, after it was already postponed twice before, first. In June of last year, postponed to August, and then August postponed to November, and November postponed to February. So we'll see what happens in February. So, as a researcher now in academia, trying to publish papers that are relevant to risk assessment, this is really, we have a problem here. So this is really a very slow process getting from, as the theme cells to solutions, seems like it's a multi-decade process. And so I think at least from where we sit, we can't, as researchers and risk assessors do much about sort of the risk management part, other than in terms of, exercising our political rights. But in terms of the risk assessment, we really need better, stronger, faster risk assessment so that, risk management can be done in a more expedited manner. And so this is where our Texas A&M Superfund Research Center is really trying to use disasters as a test bed for developing the sort of better, stronger, faster approach to risk assessment. And that's because when you have a disaster, you can't wait decades for a decision. In our first cycle from 2017 to 2022, we had Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Florence, had ITC Terminals fire in Houston. In our second cycle in 2022, that we're finishing on in next year, is East Palestine, the Richmond, Indiana fires. So disasters are, even though each one is an individual, they do happen with some regularity, but they also provide a chance to really test these types of new approaches in order to try to see if we can accelerate this risk assessment process. So in terms of the risk assessment paradigm, I'm going to start with exposure, since that is sort of what's the most prominent when a disaster occurs. And so in our toolbox for next generation risk assessment, we are focusing on non-targeted analytical methods as sort of a rapid way to try to characterize the range and breadth of exposures, because it's one of these situations where if you don't measure it, it's not there. Whereas these non-targeted methods really give a broader view of what is potentially there, even if they're more limited in terms of, validated identification and also quantification. So the two methods that we're applying are ion mobility mass spectrometry, as well as proton reaction transfer mass spectrometry. And the latter is on a mobile platform on this mRapid van, so it can actually drive to disasters and sample the air, whereas the ion mobility is more, we've used it, say, for soil samples or sediment samples that are not in the air phase, vapor phase. But again, it can't be done in isolation. There needs to be a first, especially for disasters where things are geographically, spatially very heterogeneous. We need geospatial methods to analyze and visualize the information, including sort of that public-facing dashboards to help through the communication. And that ties in again with the research engage the community engagement and research translation, which means really partnering with government agencies, with nonprofits, with communities in order to communicate the data that we generate. And these all really need to work together in order for this to really succeed and move to a solution rather than just, publishing papers. So, as an example from the ITC fire in 2019 to 2020, so those who don't remember, there was a very large fire at a storage facility in Houston. 20 plus million tons of hazardous waste was released into the Houston ship channel. There is, burning of the gigantic smoke plumes. And so we sort of focused on the water sampling part because this was right next to the Houston Ship Channel. Not only the substances that were being stored were released, but also the very large amount of PFAS containing firefighting foams also ended up being released into the channel. So we partnered with the Galveston Bay Foundation. They had a boat that had access to the surface water. We had our trainees go out and collect samples and basically test them for PFAS. Had community engagement. We made sure that TCEQ, TGLO, other state government agencies, as Harris County Health Department, were aware of what we were doing. We held sort of public fora, community fora, to sort of disseminate our results. And then it was featured in several dozen sort of print and TV stories. Now, in addition to the PFAS, we focused on PFAS because the TCEQ and EPA only did PFAS sampling at a single time point, whereas they sampled other types of semi-volatiles as well as volatiles and metals at other time points. So they had already done the sampling. We didn't want to duplicate that. But we did take their data off their dashboard and try to analyze and visualize that geospatially. So, it still took a few years from the fire in 2019 to actually, analyze all the data, publish it, get it peer reviewed, and such. But, this is certainly, faster than, 20 years or decades it takes in a typical type of risk assessment process. So some key technical approaches that we applied. So data mining, really the TCEQ EPA data was not easily sort of downloadable from their dashboard. And so we developed some web scraping tools to do that. We did geospatial analytics and visualization, again, the non-targeted methods using iMobility. And then really that risk research translation with the risk assessment focus. For instance, we put the water concentrations in the context of drinking water standards, even though, of course, nobody drinks directly out of the Houston Ship Channel. We could also there are recreational sites along the Houston Ship Channel, so we kind of adapted those to kind of incidental drinking water if people are are splashing in the water at the recreational site to try to put those concentrations in context. And again, that engagement across government communities and nonprofits was really essential to the success. So this was sort of a rapid exposure assessment over 12 to 24 months with some risk characterization based on existing sort of toxicity information. So another example is the East Palestine disaster, so the train derailment and subsequent fire. So that occurred in February of 2023. We were actually with our collaborators at Carnegie Mellon able to go out and do some mobile sampling with the PTR within a couple of weeks. Again, we also took data that had been posted by EPA and tried to develop a risk characterization, a hazard interpretation that is more easily digestible to the public. And that ended up with 100,000 views on Twitter, and also interviews with Washington Post, with NPR, et cetera. And so really trying to disseminate that information in a way that is more interpretable. We also, went back to sample afterwards while they were doing cleanup, and there are some initial results published in July of that year. And then there's also this R20 sets of R21s that were funded about a year later to go back again to continue monitoring. So this is now, a shorter time frame, sort of rapid exposure assessment within sort of 6 to 9 months. Again, trying to put some of these in context of existing toxicity values for the chemicals for which that exists, and also for interpretation, not just collecting new data, but helping to facilitate that research translation and risk communication of the data that had been published by government agencies. So again, similar sets of technical approaches: data mining, geospatial analytics, visualization, now using the PTR as the for non-target analysis because it's a vapor phase. And then again, really research translation with a risk assessment focus, and again, engagement with the government agencies, with local nonprofits, with the communities as being really essential. So those are some examples from exposure assessment. Next, I wanted to turn to hazard identification and dose response. So as I'm sure everyone is aware, there's been a move to move away from experimental to animal studies to develop what so-called new approach methodologies in toxicology. And I'm going to talk about both some in vitro approaches as well as some in silico approaches to both identify hazard as well as to characterize dose response. But again, having that visualization and data analysis approaches to communicate as well as to engage with various partners at different, outside of academia is being really essential to the success of these endeavors. So I'm going to go back to Hurricane Harvey now. So this was a really massive rain event in 2017, leading to a major redistribution of contaminants. Houston and the Houston Ship Channel, Galveston Bay has a long history of sort of releases for contamination. And such a large sort of weather event can really redistribute those contaminants. So we saw, looking at sediment concentrations that pre and post Hurricane Harvey, there definitely seemed to be an increase in pH concentrations in the sediments, and this is likely due to just runoff from the massive rain from the soil on the land into the ship channel and the bay. And then there's also potential for contamination in residential areas due to the flooding. So it can take many. There is a lot of air, certainly documented air releases from, say, the storage facilities and other petrochemical facilities that were flooded, and those floodwaters went into communities. You can see sort of that rainbow sheen in some of these photos from the press. So here we focused on a small area near the Houston Ship Channel, in which we had community partners to do some sampling and to really test real mixtures in vitro. So as well as conducting the as well as doing some chemical more traditional chemical analysis. So what we did, so this is the overall study design. We tested for pHs because that is sort of a classic concern for the area given its industrial history. But then we took a suite of iPSC-derived cells as well as HUVEC, so human-derived cell models, to looking at both functional endpoints as well as cytotoxicity and testing whole mixtures, sort of extracts with in serial dilution to try to see whether just sort of empirical bioactivity using these types of in vitro systems can help to identify hazard, identify hotspots, and then using that pH data as kind of a validation, since we know that there's likely pH contamination. Can, on the one hand, can the pHs explain or predict the bioactivity so that there's a concordance between them? But then also, spatially, are they correlated? So we did see that there is a significant spatial correlation between the patterns of PAH, and then especially when we translate those concentrations into potential cancer risk levels, and the cell-based phenotypes in terms of bioactivity. This thing in the middle here shows sort of our sort of ToxPi approach, where we try to prioritize based sort of a semi-quantitative prioritization approach, where we look at all the different phenotypes across the different cells, cell models, and try to see which ones are the most potent and have the broadest range of different types of effects across our battery. And then, as shown on the bottom, there is this sort of correlations between the bioactivity and pHs. And, so we concluded that we can use just sort of these types of more semi-empirical approaches of testing whole mixture extracts in cell-based models to really look at that whole mixture effect, to try to identify areas and prioritize areas of greater concern. And it can be used for sort of a quantitative risk characterization. And you can say, well, what level of dilution or cleanup would be needed to get these to be not bioactive in these? So it's sort of a, not worrying about the specific endpoint, but just saying, as long as these extracts are not, perturbing the functional or being toxic in cells, that can be kind of a benchmark for cleanup. So this is an in vitro, and I wanted to finish with a more in silico approach, looking at a sort of a tiered hierarchy for points of departure. So this is much more quantitative in terms of, so in traditional risk assessment, this is a type of thing that was done in the EPA assessment for trichloroethylene. You have exposure on the right. You look at concentration times intake, exposure frequency times exposure duration, and then develop a sort of lifetime average daily dose. And then you would compare that with a toxicity value like a reference dose. So reference dose is the point of departure, which is the concentration or the dose at which there's a low no sort of no adverse effect, and then you divide that by a number of uncertainty factors to get to derive a sort of reference value that is safe for including susceptible subpopulations. So these exposure values and toxicity values are then combined into like a hazard quotient or a margin of exposure, to as a sort of a quantitative unitless benchmark as to whether the exposure is low enough or we need to do cleanup to reduce exposure concentrations. So traditional way is, as with trichloroethylene, develop a regulatory authoritative point of departure. This could be EPA, ATSDR, Cal-EPA, and then compare it to an exposure level, and then that determines whether standards, drinking water standards, soil cleanup standards, et cetera. But if there's no value, there's no regulatory authoritative assessment, then often it's basically no data equals no risk. Or, for food additives, say at FDA, there is a food contaminants, there's a threshold of toxicological concern, which is sort of just a single number saying if it's below that, then we can kind of, if the exposure is below that, then we can kind of waive the need to for more detailed hazard identification. But these regulatory authoritative points of departure cover really a very limited set of chemicals. Now, I know there's a lot of emphasis in trying to move beyond experimental animal studies and, say, well, the human-based models are better, they're more relevant. But as was said in the previous one of the previous talks, there's still a long ways to go to for the experiment for these new approach methodologies to really cover the range of endpoints and cover the complexities that that an experimental animal model allows. So if you think of having this sort of counterfactual, that if we were to have a new authoritative regulatory assessment that was based on animal studies in the absence of human data, we would make decisions based on them. We would clean up, we would develop standards, et cetera. So based on that counterfactual, can we use in silico methods to derive surrogate or predicted points of departure that are calibrated to those existing regulatory authoritative points of departure? And so we have two different approaches that we've developed to do that. One is a surrogate, what we call a surrogate point of departure, that's based on analyzing this sort of the database of existing experimental animal studies. So this is based on EPA's ToxVal-DB. Now, the thing is that there's a lot more animal studies or chemicals with animal studies, and even just chemicals with guideline studies, but this goes beyond the guideline studies. But there's a lot more chemicals than there are actual authoritative assessments, because authoritative assessments require a systematic review, they require a peer review, and they require a lot of person hours, person years in order to develop them. But maybe we can use this database of studies to sort of develop a statistical approach. Well, we have this many study animal studies, their points of departure are this. If we were to, pretend that a authoritative study were to be conducted, what, the point of departure would be in this range, and how can we calibrate that to the existing points of departure that are already out there? So in this, we found that about the 25th percentile from this ToxVal-DB, so not the most sensitive study, but one in, in the lowest quartile, is sort of a good surrogate for doing that whole authoritative assessment process. And this approach expanded the number of oral points of departure by more than 10,000 chemicals, and inhalation points of departure by more than 2,000 chemicals. And this was actually implemented by EPA for oral PODs through their, what they call the database calibrated assessment process. So basically, they took the approaches from Orizano and then developed an internal or an EPA kind of version of that workflow. And this was reviewed last year, about a year ago, by the Board of Scientific Counselors. There is a publication that came out. It's actually it's 2026 date, but it came out last year, that applied it to 1,000 chemicals that currently lack human health assessments. And a little bird told me that they are trying to, at least the authors of this are trying to develop sort of an inhalation version of this as well. Now, of course, this is limited because there's tens of thousands of chemicals that have no data in ToxVal-DB, no animal studies at all. And then, we're not likely to expand in vivo testing of chemicals substantially in the near future. So it's not like we're going to get from 10,000 to 20,000, because we're not going to test those 10,000 chemicals were tested over, 5 decades of experimental animal studies. And, that rate has actually been going down. And so this is kind of what we can do with this type of approach. There's not sort of much sort of incremental gain going forward. But can AI and machine learning come to the rescue and try to extend this further? So, we've been developing sort of a series of QSAR-based points of departure based on chemical descriptors. So, unlike QSARs that are trying to predict sort of carcinogenic or not, these are QSARs that are trying to predict a number, that is the point of departure. So, first in 2018, what we call the conditional toxicity value predictor, then 2024, building on the Orizano work, really developing a two-stage machine learning model. And both of these we compared with what was at the time sort of the ToxCas plus IVIVE HTTK approach. And we found that it performed better in predicting those regulatory points of departure than the sort of high-throughput screening and high-throughput toxicokinetic approach, with much smaller root mean squared errors, less bias, and much better R squareds of about a half, so accounting for about half the variance through these chemical descriptors. And then, of course, these were also limited in that first, because of the way machine learning works, it assumes that every training data point is perfect. And the uncertainty estimate then is just based on sort of cross-validation, sort of leaving out 20% and trying to predict those. And it's the same uncertainty for every prediction, but we know that the uncertainty must be different depending on the particular chemical, because it depends on how much training data is available near that particular new chemical structure. And then the other thing is that certain classes of chemicals, these really depended on sort of a standardized QSAR workflow, and some classes of chemicals were excluded from that. So again, more advanced machine learning methods to the rescue. This was just came out last month, and the final version just came out a couple of days ago in Nature Communications. But this is what we call uncertainty-aware machine learning. So it addresses both of these types of uncertainty for each prediction, meaning that each prediction has its it'll determine what the confidence interval for that prediction is based on how that what is available in the training set to inform that prediction. This also has a web app so that you can enter your own chemicals, although we pre-calculated for over 100,000 chemicals. And so this is really interesting because it identifies certain hotspots both for uncertainty as well as for potency. So for uncertainty, like polychlorinated metals, alkaloids, there's a lot of uncertainty in those because of the lack of data of sort of training data. And then a lot of the drivers of those uncertainty, again, it's I'm sorry, the lack of training data is a driver of that uncertainty, as well as sort of the molecular descriptors that are being used are really more tailored towards small organic molecules and not as applicable to some of these other chemical classes. The other thing is that you can identify kind of highly potent clusters that would then be sort of candidates for substitution in terms of sort of chemical use. So if we go back to this tier, this point of departure, use of point of departure for risk characterization, we can basically replace this no data, no risk paradigm with two intermediate approaches for surrogate or predicted points of departure. One based on analysis of existing experimental animal data, and one QSAR based, making predictions based on chemical descriptors. So these are really trying to fill these data gaps while also quantifying their uncertainty. So overall, our center is really trying to move towards use the lens of disasters to move towards better, stronger, faster, next generation risk assessment approaches. From exposure, looking at non-targeted approaches to get better exposure assessment, looking at in vitro approaches from cells, human-based cells from different types of tissues to for ha faster hazard identification. In silico and approaches for faster dose response assessment, but I don't want to. I don't. I can't emphasize enough the importance of particularly for exposure, geospatial tools for improving the communication, as well as broad engagement to really facilitate that research translation and implementation of these approaches. So that hopefully I didn't go over too much, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chu. We have a couple of questions for you. How did your environmental measurements compare to the government's, including LODs?
Well, so because for the non-targeted methods, it was difficult to because it's all semi-quantitative, so it was difficult to compare. We did, find acrolein, for instance, which was one of the ones that had the highest hazard quotient, and we, confirmed that we could find that. I mean, the EPA they had detections for acrolein, and then we did find that as well in our non-targeted mobile sampling.
Okay. Another question. Relative potency factors weren't available for these pHs, so you could use in vivo data to estimate toxicity for the mixtures?
So I think we for cancer risk, for instance, we only use the ones that had relative potency factors to estimate the toxicity and estimate the sort of cumulative cancer risk. And so that is sort of what we compared with our in vitro data to see whether, there's a correlation between bioactivity and the sort of and the sort of more traditional approaches for estimating sort of hazards, but we also did it for the non-cancer effects for which it's sort of a different subset of the PAHs.
Thank you. And just a reminder, if you guys have any more questions, put it in the Q&A. I have one more for you. What have been some outcomes of your community engagement efforts?
Yeah, so one of the things, for instance, in Galena Park, which is in Greater Houston, we work with them not just to, we tested for soil contaminants for heavy metals. They're surrounded by industry essentially on all sides. They also experienced a lot of flooding during Hurricane Harvey. They actually had the biggest release of petrochemicals in that after that hurricane into their neighborhoods essentially. So really, that sort of nexus of flooding plus lots of industry, plus of course their low socioeconomic status. So we really work with them on trying to develop what we call sort of a master plan. And this is really engaging with their landscape architecture folks. So, though sort of the chemical risks were kind of the foot in the door, but once you start engaging with communities, especially communities like Galena Park, you discover that there's a wide range of different sort of stressors that they are experiencing, of which chemicals is one. And so in this engagement with the developing a master plan, it was sort of simultaneously to try to reduce flooding, which in itself is problematic, but also flooding that would move contaminants from these industrial facilities into their neighborhoods. So trying to sort of develop solutions that kill multiple birds with one stone kind of thing. They were actually after the master plan, they were able to get some funding to start to do some sort of construction drawings for installing this type of green infrastructure. Oh, I should mention that it is a sort of a green infrastructure-based master plan as well. So there's also the co-benefits of having more green space, having more trees that also reduce air pollution and also are better for flooding. So really, that's kind of a paradigm that we're trying to replicate in terms of that engagement to really address these sort of cumulative stressors that these communities will face.
Okay. And a follow-up question, I guess. Very, very informative. Thank you. I know you're interested in mixtures. Have you tested your paradigm for various mixtures? How well does it expand into this space?
So we've done some experiments and with a number of our projects have done experiments with testing mixtures versus single chemicals in the mixtures or our design mixtures. And we've done this with not just like a single class like BHs, but also sort of a diverse set of Superfund chemicals essentially. And in general, we found that, well, first, additivity is better than independent action in terms of explaining, at least in vitro, the total effect from the mixture. And then additionally, it's often the case that the concentration additivity actually underestimates the potency of the whole mixture. And so, we don't have a full mechanistic understanding of that because, again, we're testing diverse sets of compounds often with different types of mechanisms. We're arguing that it's testing the whole mixture is probably the safer thing to do right now rather than just in terms of erring on the side of protection of public health rather than trying to do the one component at a time.
And I guess that they came with the same question within the similar compounds like pH versus metals and pH.
It's the same thing that we find that generally there's obviously variation, but it's often the case that the concentration addition doesn't is it underpredicts the potency, underpredicts the effect.
Okay, one more. What challenges do you face to work with local government agencies for risk communication? Can you share your experiences working with local agencies?
Yeah, so it's I think the state level agencies are often, they have a lot of things on their plate, and they do want to be informed because they don't want to be surprised as to what you're doing. So there's really communicating ahead of time, well, we're doing this, we're testing for this, and they just want to make sure that, a community member doesn't say, oh, Texas A&M found this, and therefore, and be surprised. The local health agencies, as well as sort of the local nonprofits, are more in terms of, partnering kind of relationships. Like with Galveston Bay Foundation, really, working together. They had a boat, we had a way to sample, where they're both interested in the water quality, and so trying to, find ways in which we can kind of help help each other, kind of thing. So.
Well, I don't see any more questions, so thank you very much again for your talk. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yes. And with that, I wanted to say thank you all of you for joining us today, and thanks for excellent presentations, and thanks the presenter for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations and research with us. And to close out, I would like to welcome back Mali Velasquez to go over some final reminders. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Natalia. So before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Just look under tips, questions, and support. Here are a few ways to learn more about the Superfund research program. The SRP website homepage link will be posted in the chat. I encourage you to check it out and check out the various components of their website to learn more about the program and initiatives. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's Clouen webinars, please refer to the clouen.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to also follow NIEHS on X, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to the Risky Learning listserv for more information about upcoming SRP webinars. And with that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you so much for your participation, and thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.